In today's episode...
So as we launched, because of the infomercial, because of the utility of the product, it really became a massive selling item. Public knowledge out there, Nutribullet Capital Brands, we reached numbers in excess of $500 million for a very closely owned company. And, wow. And quite large EBITDAs. And we built from a very, very small team, never really became that large. We believed in real strong management and a very good culture within the organization and not a bureaucracy.
This week's episode is sponsored by AppSumo, the marketplace entrepreneurs trust to buy and sell products that grow small businesses into name brands. There's no better place for tools to help you build and grow your business. Whether you're a content creator, designer, or marketer, they're connected to some of the hottest tech companies, so you don't have to waste time searching for great stuff. AppSumo makes it easy for you to automate and boost your productivity so you can actually focus on your business. Sign up at AppSumo.com or hit the link in the description below. Okay, welcome to another episode of Creator Lab. This is your host, Bilal Zaidi, and I have got a very special guest today, Colin Sapire. Welcome to the show, Colin.
Thank you so much, Bilal. It is so nice being on. Thank you.
Colin, so look, we actually go back a few years now, and you know, first of all, to let people know, you're the founder of Nutribullet, and now you've got a new company called Beast Health. We're going to talk all about that today. Nutribullet, if you're listening to this and you haven't heard of Nutribullet, which is probably not anyone, most people have heard of it. It is probably, I don't know if it's the most successful, but the basically invented the modern day blender that we know, that we, I use it still every day in my kitchen. I've had it for many years. And you were the founder of that. You've got a crazy story coming from South Africa to the States. And we're going to go into a lot of that today. And also, what your new company is, why you've created it, your kind of philosophy on health. But before we get into that, I do want to just say that we actually know each other from real life. This is not just a random Twitter person that we've spoken in DMs or something. We've spent like many an evening together having dinner. You, when I worked at Chai to Water, I got to know you through that. So yeah, great to have you on and to reconnect again. We've stayed in touch through the pandemic, but I'm glad we got to finally do this and record together.
Fantastic, Bilal. I'm excited about it and excited to chat to you about my history and the current Beast Health project, as well as the future.
Amazing. So look, let's go back a little bit, because as a listener can hear right now, your accent also sounds not American like mine, and a little bit different to mine. You're from South Africa. And let's talk a little bit about landing in the States from South Africa, and maybe a little bit about what it was like in South Africa growing up in your family. Was it a business family? Like what was your childhood like there?
Okay, great. No, so I was born in Cape Town. And I lived in Port Elizabeth for a number of years. My family had moved to Port Elizabeth. And my parents were in business. They they built a wholesale stationery business in Port Elizabeth. It was later sold out to a public company in South Africa, but they started off with nothing in South Africa, as I did here. The story is that I used to work on my vacations. I used to go out with the delivery trucks delivering wholesale stationery to companies like Ford Motor Company that used to operate outside Port Elizabeth. But really, I'm from South Africa. I'm, born in Cape Town, went to university in Cape Town, and was educated, went to university, the University of Cape Town, and I studied a commerce degree there. And in about... in 1986, I got on a plane with my girlfriend at the time and left, not knowing where we were going to settle, but eventually got a tourist visa in Europe to come to the States. We were actually refused maybe five times because we were young. I was 26 and my girlfriend was 21. So we were refused visas to get into the US at that time, because the US was quite strict on young people who didn't have a real solid place that they were living in at the time. didn't have any structure, didn't have a job in South Africa, whatever. Anyway, long story short, we finally got to Los Angeles and lived on a friend's floor in their home for about 3 months. That's how we got to the Utes.
And how did you know those people? Were they friends from South Africa or did you just meet them on the way?
No, they were very good friends. Living in South Africa in those days, most young guys and girls really thought very carefully about whether to stay in South Africa at that time or to leave. And I had very, very good friends that had prepared years before to come to the States. They'd actually come over to the States. They'd got their positions in mostly accounting firms at that time. And they were sponsored before they arrived in the US for their positions. I was a little bit different. I was took a few more risks and was not as prepared for emigrating to the States. So I arrived, slept on the friend's floor again and with my girlfriend for about 3 months, and then actually found a position in an accounting firm in 1986 through the classified section of the LA Times.
That's a throwback. All right. So, and why LA? What made you pick LA? I mean, a great place to land, of course, but was that kind of always the plan as you headed to America? Was there like something growing up that you thought of, like Hollywood or something like that? Just curious if you, what the reason was for that.
No, you know that we really had decided to spend a couple of years traveling around the world in order to determine where we wanted to live and where we wanted to settle down. So our objective was at that time, 26 and 21, was to have a good time traveling the world. And we had very good friends that I had studied with and lived with in South Africa when we studied at the University of Cape Town, and knew that they were here and knew that they'd be very accommodating to us. So our long-term plan wasn't to live in Los Angeles or the US, but it was to come and look around, see what Los Angeles was about. Remember, coming from Africa, I'd never been to the States before. So we didn't know what to expect. And obviously getting here to Los Angeles and getting off the plane and heading up the 405 was quite an experience for a South African kid who had never been
very to different
the States
world.
Before.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, I'm sure you fell in love with it like everyone else does. But we could probably talk for an hour just about your time back then. But for the sake of time, we'll move on. Talk to me a little bit about the beginnings of Nutribullet, because like you talked about 86, you got an accountancy job. You built some skills, I take it, given that line of work. When did the seed of the idea for Nutribullet come around? And what was the story around starting that?
Yeah, so I'll try and keep this a little bit short, but from working for an accounting firm, I opened my own practice in Beverly Hills, California. First out of home, then in Beverly Hills, built up a practice, started taking on clients on a commission type basis, running their businesses out of our CPA practice. And eventually met up with a guy who was doing infomercials, had a long history in infomercials. I knew not too much about infomercials. Going through tax seasons and whatever, and being an immigrant, wasn't an expert on infomercials. But I took on the management of in those days, it was the Body by Jake Bunn and Thigh Rocker infomercial. And that's how I was introduced to the infomercial world. So long story short, the in-between story is that I developed a relationship with this guy and built these infomercial businesses. And instead of running them as only infomercials, we then converted those businesses into real businesses. So instead of spending the media on infomercial media for years or for a couple of years and then having the project disappear, what we did was we took the product into retail. We managed the infomercial buying process quite well. We developed systems to manage these shows and therefore built out brands. And we came across developed a product called the Magic Bullet. And that's actually how we transitioned into the Nutribullet.
Got it.
So in 2012, I founded or co-founded Capital Brands, which then at that stage owned the Nutribullet, the Magic Bullet, the Baby Bullet. We had a Dessert Bullet. We had quite a few different products with the Bullet brand. And why the development of the Nutribullet was that we had the little Magic Bullet, and I, as a person who realized that I needed to exercise a lot, wasn't getting the right nutrition in order to exercise. So I started running marathons and ran quite a few of them, but was eating steak and fries and eating a lot of cookies and desserts and stuff like that. Really didn't love salads and vegetables, and therefore had started using a Vitamix machine and used that to create a week's worth of smoothies. So I looked at what we were doing with the Magic Bullet, which was a smaller machine, and decided to develop that into something that I could have the smoothies that I needed to fuel my work, to fuel everything that we all do on a daily basis. I realized that by converting that little Magic Bullet into a larger machine, we could do almost the same work as a Vitamix machine, except we could do it for, make it into a much less expensive product, much more efficient in the blending of vegetables and the consumption of those vegetables. That's the long story or short behind the Nutribullet.
That makes sense. So, and just to talk about that in particular, so the Vitamix was around already. That's like a larger machine normally, right? I don't know if it was like that back then, but...
Correct. It was like that back then, larger and quite expensive.
Yeah, so what was the main differentiator? Was it the price? It was also the fact you mentioned you could blend a lot more efficiently. But like, just to be specific, what do you remember the price points of both, like in comparison? And in terms of like the experience of using it? Because I've only really used the Nutribullet. I've never used any of those, because by the time I bought one of these, Nutribullet was already the big boss. So do you remember off the top of your head what the price points were?
Yes, no, definitely. So the Nutribullet was priced from, say, $79, $89 to $129, different depending on the size Murdo at that time. A Vitamix machine at that time was generally between $400 and $600. They did come out with a similar machine to the Nutribullet, as did many who copied our Nutribullet in those days after seeing the success.
Got it. And just whatever you're able to share, at the height of the success of Nutribullet when you were there, what was the kind of size of the business? Are you able to share like even a range of revenue or countries you're in or anything like that?
Yeah, you know that the Magic Bullet, first of all, created a lot of momentum. It was out there for a long time. And we had large numbers of sales, a few million units a year. The Nutribullet came out, and straight away, as we launched, it went crazy. People were driving between Target stores looking for the Nutribullet. So as we launched, because of the infomercial, because of the utility of the product, it really became a massive selling item. Public knowledge out there, Nutribullet Capital Brands, we reached numbers in excess of $500 million for a very closely owned company, and quite large EBITDAs. And we built from a very, very small team, never really became that large. We believed in real strong management and a very good culture within the organization, and not a bureaucracy. So we tried to keep the company nimble. And at the height, I think we probably had about 150 people total, maybe 75 in our corporate office and 75 in our customer support area.
Amazing. And so just to reiterate that, close to $500 million in revenue at the height. At the numbers that reported, for eventually you sold it to a private equity firm or something like that, right? Was that 2020?
That was in 2018. And most of the reason was because my partner and I were going in different directions. I'd grown very, very keen on nutrition and health and wellness and developing product to meet that need, to meet the need of allowing people to consume more whole foods, to consume foods that are designed in nature and not designed by marketers or factories.
Got it. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And just the only reason I mentioned the numbers, this is not just to show off about how great a success it was. It is more just to paint a picture for people. I think people know it was a huge success, but even as an outcome for you, as the founder, it was a good outcome. You sold it to private equity in 2018. But let's move on to, I mean, and for people wondering, you can Google how much you think it would be sold for. It's probably in the hundreds of millions, given that you were doing that amount of revenue in that at the height with good EBITDA margins. But let's now transition into kind of what you're working on now, because the kind of frame I had for this conversation was, you know, the difference between what you did in the past versus today, right? You built Nutribullet primarily, it sounds like, especially in the beginning, from that massive, you know, drive of infomercials when TV, you know, infomercials really worked, right? Maybe you can tell me they still work. I'm not sure. But I'm sure it's very different, a different landscape today as it was back then. And what you're working on now, Beast Health, is basically an extension of what you left off with at Nutribullet. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Beast Health? What is it, and directly compared to what you've done in the past?
Yeah, so with Beast Health, the story is that during the Nutribullet days, we built a lot of health and wellness type projects. We had a team Nutribullet that used to sponsor the LA Marathon. We were second to ASICS, but it was called, the Expo was the Nutribullet Health and Wellness Expo. We developed school programs in-house. We brought in registered dietitians. We had a strong group of full-time people who were expert in nutrition. And we built the school program where we went into, over time, into 35 schools for 3 months each. So we had our program, we brought our Nutribullets into the schools, the teacher within the school taught the kids about nutrition, about vegetables. And our Nutribullet product at that time was an exceptional product in exciting kids about vegetables. You know, we saw and other school programs, nutritional programs going into schools and kids being very, very bored. When the kids had this beautiful little appliance in front of them and could play with it and decorate it. So we were really became passionate about going into schools and teaching kids about the value of nutrition and consuming more of nature's foods. So the objective was, once having sold Nutribullet in 2018 and Capital Brands and the whole company, was to go straight back into the world of nutrition and small appliances and to develop the absolute best in class delivery system that people could use to consume much more of vegetables and fruits. Again, foods that grow in the garden, on a farm, in the green section, in the produce section of your supermarket.
Yeah. One question I had was that transition point, because a lot of people I've had on the show, they might have had multiple successes in business, but a lot of them have just had one, and they say, look, that killed me for 10, 15 years, 20 years, whatever it was, and after that, I need to, you know, they want to keep their mind engaged, but they might do some investing, they might want to spend more time with their family, all that sort of stuff. So I'm curious for you at your age, where you've worked really hard all these years, you've got the big success where, you know, you had a good financial outcome as well. Talk me a little bit about that moment, because I know from our previous conversations, you were kind of like trying to take it easy for a while, I think. And you were kind of just called back to it, sounds like. You were like, no, I need to have one more go at this or whatever. So just take me back to how you thought about that, because many people get to that at different stages. I mean, it doesn't always have to be you sold your company for a crazy amount of money. It could be you've got comfortable when you previously weren't comfortable. I would even say, from my personal point of view, I haven't sold my Nutribullet company to a private equity firm, but even going from the hungry 16-year-old kid where I started an e-commerce business, where I had zero money, to now where I'm pretty comfortable, there's a little bit of the hunger you kind of lose, right? Because that hunger you need right in the beginning fuels you, but then as you grow older and mature, you realize that isn't necessarily the only thing in life. Obviously, you need to find that balance, but I found them to be kind of like two ends of the spectrum, and there's a constant dance between still being hungry but maintaining happiness. And when you become too comfortable and happy, then you need to go the other way as well. So curious how that dance was for you in that moment as well.
Okay, cool. No, so the story is that I wasn't finished doing what I had wanted to do. I'd met all of my objectives within the Nutribullet Capital Brands entity. My partner and I were going in different directions. So I'd grown this massive passion for nutrition. Now, a lot of people would go and retire and settle down, and there's a lot of stuff to do. I did have a couple of years before we sold the Nutribullet where I did take it a little bit easier, but I definitely felt the passion growing again and understood at that time that my enjoyment in life, a lot of it is this passion for creating product, developing and designing product, and also from seeing people's lives change through getting real fuel into their bodies.
Completely.
And to making it easy to consume real, real good nutrition through vegetables and fruits and whatever. And my belief is that this system that we develop or others develop, there's a lot of good blenders in the marketplace. Through that process, I'm so passionate about what we're doing and to tell the story about how people can improve their lives.
Completely.
Through fueling their daily exercise, their work. They can do so much better at work by fueling properly and by exercising properly. You sleep better when you fuel properly and you exercise properly. So when you asked me, why didn't I go and retire and start learning how to play golf? I was never a guy who really took it that easy and played a lot of golf and skied a lot and whatever. I've always, coming to this country as an immigrant with nothing, with $650 and a backpack on my back, you know, I became extremely motivated, first of all, to support myself and my family, and then slowly transitioned into this health and wellness passion. Yeah. And the health and wellness passion just got stronger and stronger and stronger. So for me, instead of playing golf out there today, that I'm involved at the cutting edge of marketing, of developing appliances, dealing with a lot of really strong, youthful co-workers that I'm working with today, gives me just a lot of joy.
How did you guys think about designing it in a way that made it feel easy and that people would look forward to using it? Because that's how I feel about it now. Like when I basically make green smoothies or green drinks with it, mostly with like spinach and avocado and a few other different things. Is that something that you guys consciously designed? Because I know like even like the beast that's behind you, if you're watching on YouTube, like you can see it's like an open thing, right? So you can actually look inside and kind of see that beautiful color that is developed.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. So again, going back to what I said earlier, we developed the Beast Blender to operate more efficiently, to be a much better looking product that people can keep out on their counter. Most of the blenders out there are not pretty and not well designed. We've won two design awards, one of which is the G Mark Award in Japan, which is an exceptional award. We've been written up by L Day Core UK. We've been written up by most of the design magazines in Europe. So what the real nice thing about the Beast machine, and we took a lot of risk in doing this. So when you develop a product that is not your traditional NutriNinja, NutriBullet, Breville Boss, all the competitive machines out there, they all use the same technology. What I did with the Beast machine was I said, we developed the NutriBullet. It was brand new. It disturbed the marketplace. It created a whole new category of blenders, of personal blenders that were specifically used to make healthy smoothies. So what we wanted to do with the Beast Blender was create and disturb the market more. We wanted to create a blender, a personal nutritional blender that people could have out on their counter that they'd be proud of, and that would be well accepted by the design community, by the health community, by everyone out there. Because when you think about it, people go out and buy a pair of sneakers, whether it's Nike, whether it's ASICS, whatever, almost for $200 today. Now that's great, and the shoes look great, and nothing wrong with that. But if you are looking, if you think your health is important, you really, in spending the additional money, instead of the $69.99 for the Nutra Ninja, you know, ours is $185 or $155, put the additional dollars into something that's developed to create the smoothest possible smoothie in the shortest possible time that will allow you to enjoy nutrition to the fullest extent.
Yeah.
So that's my theory, was to design a machine that was perfection in providing our customer base out there with a delivery system that could allow them to much more easily consume more of nature's foods, more
completely.
Of foods.
Love that. So well, I want to go into that a little, in a little bit more detail. So take me on to day one of developing this product. Like, where do you start? Because for someone listening to this who's had an idea for a physical product, they might have used another product and found a pain point like you did. Obviously, you got to know by the time you've created the Beast Blender, by now you have lots of experience and understand it. But going all the way back, you were using a Vitamix, you said, right? So you saw there was a pain point for you, it was too big, or you needed to make a whole week's worth of a batch to make it kind of worthwhile or whatever. Another thing for me is like washing up, you know, is a huge thing for me and for a lot of people. You just want to make it very convenient in that regard. So like, you've got this idea in your head, what do you do at that point? So let's talk about Beast maybe, because now you've actually learned all these lessons. So where do you go? Because you're not necessarily designing everything yourself. You need to work with other people. So what is the kind of order in which you made that happen?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So, having the experience of building product for the past, you know, 17 prior years, got really good relationships with factories around the world in manufacturing and in production of appliances and things like that. So what I did, what my first step was to find a design firm that I could work very, very closely with. That was a very, very important step. I had ideas about what the product should look like. I had ideas about different safety mechanisms that I wanted within the product, which weren't in all the other products in the marketplace then. Just a quick example would be, we have a temperature sensor in our blade holder that if you put in hot ingredients into an enclosed vessel, it won't blend, because our sensor, which you can see over there, is going to detect the hot liquids. So that was one of my objectives in building this product, was to get the silkiest smoothie with all the ribs that we have. We have 12 ribs. Everyone else has 4. I can go on and on about the machine. So I had all the ideas and all the stuff that I wanted to execute on. So I found a small, versatile design firm. I got them to come up with 7 proposals as to design and development of the product. And eventually, out of those 7, my family, myself, friends, we all looked at this and I made the final decision on this design and this
Amazing.
Technology. So this product that we've developed is one of the very, very few blenders that has an electronic interlocking mechanism. So we got electronics going through from the base, from a PCB, from a circuit board into our blade holder, which talks to the blade holder, as opposed to all the other products out there, which use a manual spring actuation system. So there's a lot of differences, but with what we did there. So it took me maybe 2 to 3 years overall to develop this product with the relationships that I have, the manufacturing relationships and the design firm. And even today, we're still tweaking the product. It's a great product, but we continuously improve the performance of the machine.
Got it. Yeah, so to summarize, you went to a design firm, got them to propose 7 different types, you know, played around with it and said, okay, this is the route we want to take. So from that onwards, then do you need to go and create a small batch, a prototype? Like, how does it work from there? I've never done this myself.
If you look behind me over here, this is one of our first working prototypes. So this doesn't it's the same shape.
But it's very different, yeah.
From what we had originally developed with our factory, you go to a design firm, you finish the design process and engineering process, you take that to the factory. The factory then redesigns the CAD and makes it
And sorry, CAD is computer-aided design for people who don't know what that is, right? Is that
correct?
Is that the how they're going to actually make it, manufacture it? They need to make a computer version of it, right? Like the industrial design, like correct. The 3D model or whatever.
Correct. So it's a 3D model, but it's a manufacturing 3D model.
Got it.
And what happens in that process is that there's some changes that take place there. So you're still working with the design firm and the factory, because now the factory have to manufacture what the design firm designed. And often what a design firm designs, the factory would not manufacture because it's too difficult. So there's a compromise process that goes on after you've designed and you get the CAD to the factory, and the factory has to redo the CAD.
They have to adjust it. Got it. Yeah, that makes sense.
Correct.
And then so that makes sense. So now you've got to a place where you've got a product. Well, what happens from there? Because now you need to think about how you're going to get this out there to people. Is it at this point, is it ready to start manufacturing X number of units? And you need to now start going to figure out how we're going to sell this thing, create a brand. We're going to make a website to sell D2C, or we're going to sell on Amazon. Like, I'm sure there's 1,000 things you could do. So what, again, like if you were doing like an 80-20 analysis of the 20% of actions that give you 80% of the reward in this case, like what was the priority stack for you? Were you saying, I need to figure out the brand, I need to figure out our own channel first? Like, what was that thought process like?
Yeah, so what happened is that the development process is quite lengthy and detailed and complicated. You produce your first tooling, the factory produces the first units. Even after that process, we went back, we changed tooling. So it's a long, long process and a lot of hard work. To manufacture or to create a new appliance is not easy. The barriers to entry are it's expensive, and it's not the same as developing, say, a food product in the US. This is a small appliance. It takes a fortune of effort and takes a lot of time. So having said that, our introduction into the marketplace, knowing that the infomercial world has sort of declined over the years, because now the demographic of the infomercial world is possibly from 50 through to 98.
Is that just because that's the TV audience? Because the people watching, yeah.
Especially the type of audience that watches overnight infomercials.
Got it, yeah.
Because of the social networks today, obviously everyone's eyeballs are on so many other things. And, you know, Instagram, TikTok, and everything else. So the thought was that most importantly, we had developed something which we thought was going to be amazing, but we didn't know how the marketplace was going to react to what we thought was amazing. So our first intention was to do a very slow launch and to get feedback from the marketplace as to what they thought of the product. And a very, very important part of that process is by getting out the product to people that will review the machine. And that's the press, that is creators or influencers. That is to get this general feedback. So our first step was to develop a website. And that's what we did initially. And that's where we got our initial feedback. And luckily, our feedback from publications like CNET or Forbes or even, you know, Good Housekeeping, just a number of great publications out there, without our interaction with them, just came back with great reviews. So that was the exciting part, knowing that the marketplace had reacted warmly to our product. Next steps were building out the marketing, which also takes a lot of work, which we're still working on today. But we now know that we have a product that's extremely well accepted by the marketplace. And I can go on and on about the retailers that are taking us in and all of that.
I'd love to talk about that in a second, but on the product, because I know the key here is, you know, you spent so much time developing great product. How do you know which feedback to listen to and what not to listen to? Because I've spoken to many people on here where they say, you know, everyone knows, okay, to get user feedback and improve your product. But what I thought about differently, actually, there's a guy called Rahul Vora who has a company called Superhuman, which is a $30 a month email service, right? Where we all get Gmail for free and Hotmail for free, but they charge $30. And I actually still use it. And I still pay every month for some reason because it is way better than everything else. And one of the key things he said to me that stuck with me is everyone's feedback isn't the same, right? Like you have to learn to weight different types of people's feedback because, and the way he described it was, what is your core value proposition? For them, it's creating the fastest email in the world or whatever. And for someone who really cares about that one thing, they over-index their kind of feedback from that sort of person. So I'm curious, with a physical product and what you're doing, you're not working with a few thousand people. This is, you know, lots and lots of people could be using this. Like you said, a million people were using Nutribullet in the past or more. So how do you take that early feedback from, you know, publications and influencers and learn to decipher which one is the most important? Or do you need to listen to everyone equally in your case because it's a consumer product?
Yeah, that's a very, very, very good question. That time period from when we launched in April of last year, we've been going for 1 year. That period was a very, very critical period. We had to keep our ears wide open and listen through our customer support team, listen to what retailers were thinking of the product, just watch whatever was going on. And every comment was taken extremely seriously. So I'm the sort of guy who loves getting in the weeds. There's a lot of CEOs and founders who like to lead everything from the top and have a lot of people executing for them. I believe that what's critical to be successful, especially for me, is understanding exactly what the customer is saying. So I will be copied and have all the emails coming in from all of our customers.
Oh, amazing.
Especially the complaints. So any complaint is highlighted and I have discussions with our team, with our factory, with our product development people, and take that much, much further. So what we were lucky about was that generally speaking, we got 95% of the time great feedback. So there were no real changes to the machine. But the feedback that is negative is the most important feedback, and you have to search it out. So with the programs and platforms that we have today, we can see activity relating to our Beast Blender out on the social platforms and search it out and read it through and have discussions about it. So we continuously do that, but that was very, very important at launch stage. And so that's how we do it.
Got it. This episode is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. As a small business, I know you're juggling 100 balls in the air and you don't have time to interview candidates who aren't qualified for your role. LinkedIn Jobs makes it easier for you to find the people you want to interview faster and for free. Here's how to get started. in a few minutes, create a free job post on LinkedIn Jobs, and you'll tap into the world's largest professional network. Then add your job and the purple hashtag hiring frame to your profile to spread the word that you're hiring so your network can help you find the right people. Use simple tools like screening questions to make it easy to focus on candidates with the right skills so you can prioritize who you'd like to interview and hire. It's why small businesses rate LinkedIn Jobs the number one place in delivering high quality hires versus their competitors. LinkedIn Jobs helps you find the candidates you want to talk to faster, and you can post a job for free. Just visit linkedin.com/creator. Again, that's linkedin.com/creator to post a job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Now let's get straight back to the show. I love to hear that specific detail of the complaints come into your inbox, or maybe you've got it filtered somewhere you can review, but that's really interesting to hear, because I'm sure there's a lot of feedback. So to be able to, for someone at your level, as someone who's got 1,000 things to do, to prioritize that shows, you know, how important it is to you. I want to talk a little bit about infomercials and kind of what we can learn from the infomercial world, even if it's not applicable today, because my opinion is that the principles of marketing and selling a product haven't necessarily changed, you know, like the actual principles, but the way we sell them, the channels we sell them in, the things we can do have changed, which is interesting and a cool thing if you're creative, because you can actually use some of the new channels in unique ways. But if we just break down the infomercial time, right, where people are watching, you know, whether that's late at night or whatever, like, were there some, and I know you weren't the main infomercial guy out of the partnership you're in, but you obviously were exposed to what worked and what didn't. Like, what can someone listening to this learn about what works as a offer to the marketplace from the infomercial days?
Yeah. You know, the benefit to the infomercial, all sorts of media channels all have, pluses and minuses, positives and negatives. And what was great about the infomercial was that you came up with the story about your product, a half an hour story, which you then produced and made into an infomercial. You didn't have many opportunities to change that marketing and that story. And that was something which, when done properly, was exceptionally strong. And we had the demographic and the marketplace out there watching infomercials. So the combination of telling a strong half an hour story makes it quite simple from a marketing perspective, because you have one creative, you put it up on television. If the media ratios are good, you continue running. If they're not good, you have to go and redo the infomercial or just collapse the product, the project. So that was the benefit of the infomercial, that you're forced to design your marketing up front and never changed it. Now, in today's world, we have to tell the same story, but we cannot tell it in half an hour segments. So we have to tell all the benefits of our machine and develop that marketing up front. But today we do it mostly on social platforms. There still is a marketplace today for the infomercial, and it might even be something that we decide to do again at a later time, because the price of the media of the infomercials has come down because there's not as large an audience as there used to be then. So the infomercial hasn't been ruled out, and TV media hasn't been ruled out. But the exciting part about marketing today is that when you develop a product that you're extremely proud of and that your marketplace feels strongly about and is accepting of that product, the critical part is the quality and development of that product, because now we can get that out. What's really exciting is that once we realize that we have something that the marketplace loves, our creators out there react to our product very, very strongly, and therefore love using it and love showing how they're improving their health or how the design fits into their lifestyle on their kitchen counter. So we have these two different worlds of marketing, the infomercial versus today's world, which is extremely different, And what we've had to do is pivot and really relearn the marketplace today. Yeah. And all these changes that are going on a daily basis, and watch how our customers and the marketplace is reacting to what we put out there, and then change what we're putting out there to how we're seeing them react to our marketing.
Got it. Yeah, it's definitely a lot more fragmented than where you could just put it on one TV channel and know you'll get X million people watch it or whatever the numbers were. Just since we're talking about that, I'm curious, do you remember the craziest day of infomercial success you guys had? Because I'm sure there were many of these, but maybe there was one or two days you remember like, oh, wow, this is going to work. Or, oh, my God, I can't believe we sold X amount on one day. I'm just curious, like, looking back at that time, is there anything that pops in your mind?
Yeah, you know, what pops into my mind, really, the first things that are really, really important is that, say, when we launched the Nutribullet on television, we had retirement homes calling us for free units. And why would a retirement home call you and ask you for free product? And it's just quite amazing that the elderly who've lost their teeth cannot chew, need nutrition.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
These retirement homes were really enjoying the ability of the Nutribullet to break down the vegetables into a smooth smoothie and to allow the people within those homes to do so much better. So that was a really great, that created a lot of excitement for me in particular. The fact that with our initial Magic Bullet infomercial, we had kids out there that knew the whole infomercial, could recite the whole infomercial.
Oh, wow. It's like a music video.
They knew all of the characters. They had seen it so many times. I think our Magic Bullet infomercial was probably one of the most long-running infomercials ever, and probably one of the more successful infomercials ever run. So the story behind the infomercial was successful in that when the guys who were within or who were the talent within the infomercial were in airports, they were recognized as the characters within the infomercial.
Wow.
So whether it was Mimi or Mick or whoever it was in the infomercial, these people became celebrities because of the amount of airings that we aired for each of our infomercials.
That's crazy. Do you remember how many people would watch those infomercials in like a day? Do you remember from top of your head by any chance? I'm just curious to compare that to like buying media today.
Yeah, you know that we knew the demographics of every channel. So if you took Food and Wine, if you took the Golf Channel, say, the Golf Channel is mostly golfers, but you can get the numbers of each channel and you can know who you're reaching. And the cost of that media, obviously, when we used to do, say, a national spot on a Saturday morning, we used to get to probably a possible marketplace of maybe 30, 40 million people or 20
damn.
To 25 million.
Wow.
I'm not exactly sure. This goes back quite a while.
Yeah.
But if we went to a KCAL in Los Angeles, your marketplace is only Los Angeles. So out of the 20 million people that reaches out to, how many people are watching at the time? And generally speaking, we reached the whole of the US many, many times over.
I think the whole world, man, because I saw it in the UK too. So I'm curious, you mentioned, I want to circle back to something you said earlier, which was media ratios. I think that's the phrase you used. So what does that mean specifically? I think I know what it means, but you've got an accountancy background. And I'm sure as your partner and others were spending a lot of money on infomercials and you could see them working, you must have been looking at it and saying, well, how do we know what's working? So, and that's something I do a lot of in my current, business that I have as well. So I'm curious, like back then when we didn't have Google Analytics for infomercials, right? What were the kind of metrics and the way that you were able to figure out what was working to double down on?
Yeah, you know, that was one of the things that I took a lead on, which was to bring in data, data is critical. There's a few things that are critical in producing a successful or having a successful business. And data is one of the critical things. Obviously, your product, your design, your quality, your everything else is important, but data is critical. So what we did when we started out in 2000 with a couple of infomercials was, instead of having the reporting from our media buyers faxed to us in those days, we were one of the first companies that our media buyers, our fulfillment houses, our anyone who we dealt with, our telemarketers, all eventually downloaded data into our SQL servers. And we were able to do reporting on the infomercials and get to the media ratios, which were critical in making decisions on media buyers by station. In today's world, remember, we still use media ratios, whether it's on Instagram media or Facebook media or TikTok media, we still use that media ratio. And what that media ratio is, you spend a dollar, you get back $2, you get back $3, you get back $4.
Got it.
Is it a 4-to-1 ratio? Is it a 2-to-1 ratio?
Like, we call it like a ROAS, right? Like a return on ad spend or something like that?
Correct. So ROAS is the same thing as ratio. And got in today's world, whether the units are being sold on Amazon, wherever, you need to accumulate your revenue, look at your total cost of media, and relate those two numbers to each other and make a decision on how far you want to bring your media ratio down in order to increase business.
That makes sense. So what's a good ratio when you're looking at selling physical products? And obviously this varies by stage. And let's say like a venture-backed software company is in growth mode and they may be happy with a 1-to-1 ratio because they can break even and they're growing long-term and they can be more valuable. But if you're building a profitable business, which I'm a fan of, how do you, which is crazy to say that, that's something that we should be a fan of. What is that kind of ratio that you're looking at as like a minimum for what the media that you spend on?
Yeah, you know, it's a very difficult question to answer because there's so many variables that go into that decision. It depends on the stage of the business and where you're at. If you're launching and you're looking to build brand, generally speaking, you want the highest possible ratio because you have a break-even ratio that could be a 2, say, a 2 revenue to media cost. Doing a 6 or a 10, you can run a lot of media. And what you do is you bring that 10 or 6 down to an acceptable ratio. The most important thing when you're launching a product is to get the brand out there and to get people to know the product, to get the people who are influencers within the retail environment to see your product, to have everyone see it, to have friends of friends talk about the product. So to run the media at a lower media ratio is fine because you're building the brand.
Yeah, makes sense.
Over time, when you want to increase profits, obviously, when you've got all your channels working, where you've got your international channels working, your retailers selling product, there is an opportunity to change that ratio and to change direction at that time. In our place right now, it's building the brand still.
Yeah,
we are obviously interested in profit, in long-term profit, but in the short term, our objective is to make this product the most well thought of and well used product in the marketplace.
Got it. Yeah, that's really helpful. As someone who has bought media myself for a long time, do you find, the observation I have is that, for digital advertising, basically Google and Facebook run digital advertising. There's Amazon and LinkedIn have LinkedIn has a B2B foothold nowadays, and Amazon has a retail on Amazon footprint. But really, it's Google and Facebook, right? A majority of the profits made in online advertising. Though, because it's an auction, the prices of the auction have gone up over time. The cost per CPM, the cost per 1,000 impressions, which is how much it costs to reach 1,000 people, have gone up quite significantly over the years. And I'm just curious, as someone like yourself who's got experience from, running like TV ads for a long time to now doing this digital part, Do you think it's going to be sustainable? Because those businesses need to keep growing 20-30% year over year. And the way they do that is, yeah, they can get more users, potentially more people use the internet around the world still, that's growing. But really, it's like the ad auction, the price goes up, the premium goes up, and then every year, there's more of a squeeze on everyone who's buying, right? So it's no longer as profitable as it was. Let's say you ran Facebook ads 7 years ago, it was, you know, amazing. And now it's still good, but it's not as good as it used to be. So as someone who analyzes things from a data standpoint like you do, are you seeing that on like a macro scale of something you need to get ahead of? Or am I just like overreacting to that?
No. You bring up a very, very critical point. I don't know what everyone else is doing out there. I, you know, obviously network quite a bit and understand some of what's going on out there. But the story is that when you put out media, the results of the media are dependent on you, on your brand, on your team. And if you're putting out better quality media, creative that converts, gets attention, obviously that's important. So we all have our own ability to do better, and that's the competitive marketplace. So when we put out our ads for Beast Health, we want those to be cutting edge, and we have the ability, because we have a smaller team and not a bureaucracy, to create cutting edge media. And that's what we're currently working on. The product, if I can use the word crappy product, a widget that really doesn't convert, our objective is to put our investment into the product, into the quality. So say we've got stainless steel gearing. That costs a lot of money. We didn't have to use it. But as far as I'm concerned, that cost is marketing. It's not even product cost. Because by putting our investment into the product, we're going to get a better reaction. So we have control over so much versus just the marketplace performance.
That's
a
great point.
Improving all of these aspects. And then the very, very important thing is, as we were successful with our infomercials in bringing in data and analyzing, we can analyze our media in a different way to another marketer who's marketing on Facebook and Instagram or on Google or on TikTok. So our success depends on our ability to get into that Google data, into the Instagram data, and really bring that data out and actually see what's going on with the reaction from the marketplace to that creative and really understand it at a level that's hopefully much higher than our competitors. Yeah. And that's how we're going to be able to perform better with that media. It's data. And we've really got a couple of really good data people on our team right now. And this is the process that we're going through. We're extracting data, bringing it into data warehouses and analyzing it. And that's tough for guys who haven't been through this whole media ratio, data performance.
Yeah.
And that's where I believe that what we got going on today is we have some experience with a slightly older guy, but a completely youthful team with a lot of energy and a lot of intelligence. And we're putting this together, taking the experience from the past together with the view of the world of the youth.
I love it, man.
Really putting that together, hopefully, to not just to make profits, because profits are important to any business, but to change people's lives. So therefore, we're involved with charitable organizations. In Africa, in supporting AIDS orphans with nutrition, sending our Beast Blenders down to an organization that we work with in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe, called Zara Center. Very, very important to us that we're not doing that to create more sales, but just part of who we are, to changing kids' lives and people's lives.
Yeah, and I will say, Colin, just knowing you, you know, we don't have to go in detail on the charity water side, but I know personally just how important that cause was to you and your family, and just having spent time with you guys, I know how authentic that is, that message of like, we actually care about what's going on. Because, you know, my job at Charity War was to work with brands, right? And we worked on charitable basically making products together, marketing campaigns, raising money and awareness about the water crisis. And to put it frankly, a lot of the people that came to us to work with us just wanted a buzz factor to sell more product. And like, I'm not saying that's that crazy, right? Like, they're a business at the end of the day. That's partly their incentives. But I know, just like having spent time with you, that that is something that is, you know, you don't need to do the things you're doing, and you're doing that. So it's cool to see you're applying that to the new business as well. A question I wanted to bring us back to, kind of the current marketplace versus the past. So we talked about infomercials on TV. So when I think of infomercials, for some reason, I was actually thinking of like QVC style, like a channel, like a shopping channel. But when you said, oh, the Golf Channel and stuff like that, I guess we could split things into two different things. I don't even know if QVC counts as infomercial. Maybe that's something else. It's like live selling or something. But yeah, so in my head now, I've got these two things. We've got the infomercials late at night on the Golf Channel, and they're half an hour. People are going to watch them and call up and buy something or whatever it might be. And then there was the actual shopping channels, which were slightly different. Now, if we go to 2022 today, obviously a lot of the attention is online. Specifically in China, I know, I've forgotten the name of the company, but I don't know if you know much about this, but there's an app there that there's live selling of products similar to QVC or something like that. And it's the only place I've really seen it work at that scale. Obviously, there's a billion people there, and a lot of them have internet access and a growing middle class. Do you know much about that? And have you tried anything like that on the digital side, similar to the way QVC worked previously?
Yeah, you know, so first of all, QVC, which I think owns HSN today, you know, there were two larger home shopping channels. That's definitely a channel that we will use. And we've been in discussions indirectly with QVC and with QVC in Europe, in Germany. I don't know the specific shopping channel that you're talking about in China, but in China, they are quite far ahead of us sometimes in the development of technology and how they're selling. But there's a lot of other live elements in selling today, even on the Amazon platform. Mm. You can do your live, you can, on a computer, I could sit over here selling the Beast Blender live on Amazon. So all of this is coming into play now. The problem is that there's just so many channels out there to have your product, and it takes time and work effort and people to get it out there. So we're busy looking and seeing what our next steps are going to be. We've launched, obviously, quite strongly on the social channels. We've even become known in certain press reviews by publications as the Instagram blender. So we've succeeded on the social channels. We've now gone into the retail channels. So we've been invited in by the major retailers without us reaching out to them. They reach out to our support, whether it's Bed Bath and Beyond, whether it's Nordstrom's, whether it's Crate and Barrel. Really, really got a warm welcome by all of them. So the QVCs and the HSNs, absolutely, we will be on those channels in the future. The app-type live channels, absolutely. So all of those sort of things, those are our next steps out into the marketplace. And talking about the international marketplace, we'll be in the EU quite soon, you know, selling directly to customers in the UK and the EU. Companies like Selfridges have reached out to us.
Oh, wow.
And players like that. So it's all steps that need to be taken.
And that's awesome. So let's talk a little bit about that. If you go into the UK, let's say, that's a market I know well. Selfridges are already inviting you to be in, you know, for people that don't know, Selfridges is like the high-end department store with an iconic yellow bag that you walk out of and feel good about yourself. And I think the other brand that would work really well there is John Lewis. I don't know if you've sold through John Lewis before, but they have like great brand for high quality products, good customer service as well. My sister actually worked there for 10 years, so I got to learn a little bit from her on that. So like going into that market again, that is something that a lot of people are thinking about doing with their e-commerce brands. What goes into that beyond creating partnerships with retail stores like you just mentioned there?
Yeah, first of all, having a small appliance is a difficult type of launch in every market because you cannot sell our US certified UL product to someone in Germany because the voltage is different. It needs to be certified with EU certification. So that's the first step. Then you have language problems. Not problems, but you have to change the language in your user manuals, yeah, on your websites, on your product packaging, and all of that sort of stuff. So in our prior life with Capital Brands, you know, I went out and selected distributors in different countries, and we had them just buy product wholesale from us, and we used to ship to them. They used to take, you know, our creative and our everything else and use that and establish the marketplace. With this, we're doing it a little bit differently in that we really are happy with the results of our social marketing in the US, and why we are extremely feel that that's extremely important to the future of any product today is that we believe that you have to have control over your customer. As soon as you put the control of your customer into a big retailer and you don't really produce the marketing and the reaction from the customer, you're going to rely on that big retail store for people to walk through and to see your product.
Yeah.
It's the same thing in the UK and the EU and Australia and all the different markets out there, is that what you first want to do is you want to reach out to all the customers out there, support them through your own customer support. You want to teach them about your product. You want to tweak your marketing. And after that, you know, go to distributors and people like that possibly. So our launch in the EU and the UK is different from what we've done in the past, but we're taking our learnings from the US and we're duplicating that in Amazon and direct to consumer in the EU and the UK, using those retailers that are reaching out to us, who we feel is a good fit with our product.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. There's more control where you can have it now, whereas previously you didn't have the ability to have that kind of direct relationship as much as you do today, right? But that makes a lot of sense. And so the last part I want to talk about on the business side is obviously the people side, because you mentioned just before we started recording, you see yourself as the experienced person who's done this before. But I like that you're very open to seeing the parts that you might not know as much about, and you want to learn about those things. And you've gone and hired quite a young team. I think you said the person who's running it is it 27 years old, or is that right?
Yes, yes. So Juliana is, I don't know whether we can talk age or whatever on this podcast, but
oh, yeah.
She manages most of our business on a day-to-day basis. As I had mentioned to you, she's exceptionally strong, just a wonderful person, and has learned the marketplace out there extremely quickly, whether it's Amazon, whether it's our social platforms, really just an amazingly quick learner and intelligent person. So I believe that by bringing in youth who understand the marketplace together with the experience that I have and a couple of others, that mixture of the old experience, because when you get involved in a direct-to-consumer business, what is critical is logistics.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you bring your product into a warehouse, how do you get that product out to the customer in the most efficient manner? Having gone through spending a day a week when I started the Nutribullet business and the Capital Brands business, I spent a day a week in our warehouse watching the containers getting delivered and unpacked, going into inventory, and then getting shipped via FedEx or UPS or whatever. It was a large part of our business. All of those learnings I have today, and I'm transferring most of that over to our younger team, who are quickly picking up on the current situations with the warehousing, with the Amazon warehouses out there, with all the different variations of warehouses that can get product to our customer the same day or the next day.
Yeah.
So
and that makes sense. And so are you using like a third-party logistics company, or are you using like Amazon has their FBA, I think it's called, service, where they do the fulfillment for you for their own platform anyway? Or are you using your own warehouses. Like, how did you come up with that decision? Because I've heard that can be quite, I mean, this could be a whole podcast just about that. So curious, like, how you thought about that.
Yeah, you know, that's what we've done over the last year. We've had to relearn the logistical, the fulfillment process out there of product. And we've had to understand who are the players in the marketplace today. And how they, you know, and then to select, and we still haven't made the best selections. We're still moving warehousing, but we have learnt a fortune in this process. Amazon is a great player. Amazon's had problems over the last year. So since launch, we launched at the exact wrong time to launch a product because of logistical issues, because of the container pricing, because of the port issues, and because of everything else. So we've had to be very quick in adapting to the issues that are out there. But an Amazon solution, if you use FBA, is great. And then they have the MCF. So we can fulfill.
What's MCF stand for?
MCF, it's manufacturer fulfilled, manufacturer fulfillment. So
okay, and FBA is fulfilled by Amazon, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. This is also fulfilled by Amazon, but what this is that we sell on our website, and other retailers are selling on their website, which we drop ship ourselves. We push those orders or some of those orders through Amazon, and Amazon charge us a fee to deliver that unit, not for units sold on Amazon, but for units that we sell within our website environment.
Yeah.
And we can take advantage of the Amazon rates, which are quite a bit lower than most warehousing facilities in the US. But then there's a lot of competitive companies that are offering almost Amazon type arrangements, whether it's FedEx or UPS or whatever, in bringing product into the country and then distributing it to warehouses that are situated close to our customers and then delivering as the orders come in. But Amazon has a great solution.
Yeah.
Amazon has just gone through issues, which I think we all know over the last year, in capacity of their warehouses. So they've had to limit the amount of units that people bring in to the Amazon facilities. But they are working quickly to fix all of those issues.
Yeah, it must be crazy from the time that you started to now how different it is. In many ways, it's a lot more advanced, and there's a lot because e-commerce has become more prominent. But on the flip side, the expectation of the customer has gone up through the roof too, right? Because now everyone expects next day delivery for free, right? Because we're used to getting it with Amazon Prime. And now anywhere I go where I don't get, you know, I'm happy to wait a few days because I also know it's kind of ridiculous for me to expect to order something at 6 p.m. today and it to be like here tomorrow, which happens all the time with Amazon. And I almost feel bad because I'm like, I didn't need it in 12 hours, right? Like, I'm happy to wait for like 2 days if it makes it slightly better for the environment or whatever. But I think the expectations are so high. And then, you know, at the same time, you know, there's companies like Amazon who are monsters in the logistics space, so they can, you know, expand out what they do for their business for everyone else. But yeah, interesting to hear. I actually, the last episode on the show was with a guy called Ramon who bought a dog ramp business. It's kind of crazy. It was for a couple hundred thousand dollars. I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was probably a few hundred thousand. It was quite small at the time. And then he's grown it to $30 million in like a year or two. And one of the biggest changes he made was bringing the logistics in-house essentially and to not use a 3PL because he said that the margins were, it was kind of killing his margins and he couldn't control the experience as well for the customer for what they were doing. But it's interesting because yours might be completely different and your product's completely different. So I'm sure it would be different for that reason.
Correct. That part of the customer experience is critical to the success of a business. And that's why the whole business environment consists of like maybe 15 critical issues that you need to do extremely well in order to be successful. And if you let one of them go, your success will be limited. And therefore, you know, you really have to be on top of things like that. Our objective is to get our customer in the most pristine status to the customer, so that the box is well kept, looks good. When they receive it, the customer unboxing experience is amazing. And that's why our packaging was extremely important to us. Nothing has been perfect, so we've had to have improvements. But yeah, so 3PLs and all of that sort of stuff is all good. Managing your own in today's environment is tough. Finding warehousing is very expensive today. But what we found is that by finding 3PLs or warehouses that are that own their own warehouses as opposed to using other third-party warehouses are all a great solution today.
Got it. Yeah, brilliant, man. And the last question I had for you, because this has been amazing, man, we've talked about so much, is just switching gears from the business side. Is more like we started this conversation about how important it was that the health side of this was to you. That's been a common thread throughout what you've done. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, your experience now with your own health, you know, as you've gotten older and you've gone from running marathons to, you know, staying active in your own way. Like, how do you think about balancing your own health in today's age from everything that you know?
Yeah. So, you know, no one's perfect and I'm not perfect. So I just believe in that it's quite simple for me as an individual to keep my health quite good through the consumption of more of whole foods, of, again, and I repeat myself, the way that nature designed foods. So from my perspective, I try and consume mostly those type of foods. But I'm the sort of guy that if I'm going out for a dinner and I want to enjoy myself, I'm going to let loose on that food and wine. Yeah. Because most of the time, 95% of the time, I'm drinking smoothies. With our machine, I make our own desserts. So I'll use medjool dates, almond milk, and frozen bananas to make the best dessert. So I make these decisions to enjoy food, but to enjoy whole foods. But then going out for a dinner, we let loose.
That's how you balance it though, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So I also feel that, it's quite simple to me. Now that nutrition helps the exercise that I do, whether it's mountain biking, whether it's gardening, whatever I do on a day-to-day basis is fueled by my morning smoothie.
Love it, man. Yeah. Well, we're going to need that recipe that you just said there, the dates and the banana sounds amazing. Well, Colin, thanks again for coming on the show. This has been amazing. Thanks for going in so much detail. I know we went over a little bit there, but this was amazing. Was there anything we didn't get to talk about that you wanted to share?
No, it's just great catching up with you because, you know, yeah, as likewise. You said, we've spent quite a few evenings together at the Charity Water events in San Francisco, in New York, all over the place. And that's a great organization.
Yeah.
And doing amazingly good stuff. And I've met amazing people like yourself at those events. And therefore, just so nice after quite a few years to get back together and to have this conversation.
No, this was amazing. No, I appreciate it. And when I'm in LA next, I will definitely, we said we'd meet up and I need to come and see you. So I come there every few months or every 6 months or so. So I'll definitely give you a shout next time. And we'll do this in person, man. I really appreciate it. Thanks
thank
again
so,
for coming
so
on. And yeah, if you're listening to this still, thank you for being here. And let us know what you think of this. You can tweet me at BZAD on Twitter, as always. And Colin, is there a best place for people to reach you or to share anything with you if they were interested?
Yeah, you know, I'll give out my email address. It's colin@thebeast.com. So the beast.
Oh, that's an amazing email address, by the way. That's a great domain. That must have been a great, that must have been a hard domain to get, no?
I spent a bit of time finding it. You know, beast obviously is a very, very popular word out there. And so we got the trademark for the beast for appliances and, you know, put through a lot of work before we actually launched to get everything organized. And the beast is one of our URLs, but it's the one that we use for our emails.
That's a great name. That's a great, I love the name as well. For
thank
a domain you. Name, that's really good. That is a premium domain for sure. Anyway, that's your email address. And let us know what you think of this. And thanks again for coming on. And we'll see you on the next episode. Cheers.
Cheers.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/creatorlabfm. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at bzaidie, B-Z-A-I-D-I, or creatorlabfm on any other channel. I really appreciate it. It helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.